Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored, this podcast where we hear people's dyslexia stories. I'm Darius Nomdaron, your host today, and today let's talk about dyslexia and music. In particular, dyslexia and reading music. In the last episode, we had a group of parents and teachers all get together and discuss dyslexia and music, and it was a kind of a round table, and it was a bit of a wake-up call to a lot of people of, gosh, does dyslexia affect music reading? Yes, it does. Not always, but it very much can do. So we have probably someone who is the closest to having a process that helps dyslexic thinkers really master learning to read music. And in a way, inadvertently stumbling across this process, but it's developing and it's effective. So I want to introduce you to someone who's got a dyslexia story to share with you. She's a fellow of the London College of Music, which is quite a prestigious accolade, which means that it's the equivalent of like having a master's degree in music through her practice. She's a musician herself, an accomplished pianist, violinist, classical soprano singer. She's won some awards, some medals in that. She's sung in a few prestigious choirs. She's been teaching music for 40 years, everything from kindergarten children all the way up to adults and everyone in between. She's coached students to get scholarships in prestigious musical institutions like Winchester. She's helped choristers learn their theory music. She's also been a head music teacher in a school for 12 years in a prep school. And now she's training teachers how to teach music as well. And she's developed a system called the Stavehouse music system and is the founder of Stavehouse. And it's probably the closest to something that really helps dyslexics unlock the ability to move from that listening to music to reading music. It was really prompted by children who are doing the Suzuki method and wanting to find a way to go from that ability to play excellently by ear, etc., over to sight reading. So I'd really like to introduce you to Ruth Travers. Ruth, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's really good to be here today.
I'm really looking forward to hearing your story, because I think dyslexia and music is one of the reading music is one of these kind of unexpected difficulties, hidden difficulties that of people with dyslexic traits. And, you know, you yourself, you think you might have some mild dyslexic traits, but you're not kind of officially identified with dyslexia yet or anything like that. You've got a son with dyslexia, and you've met a lot of students with dyslexia as well. So really looking forward to hearing your story about how, you know, where it all began.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, what was life like for you before dyslexia came on your horizon?
Life was fine. I was always just very gifted at music. So I suppose I put my energies into that. For me personally, there were elements to my life that I can now look back and say that was probably my dyslexia. I would, disorganization, you know, very disorganized, sort of, I would perhaps miss certain instructions, and I never felt that I couldn't keep up or anything like that. And obviously with music, I think because I was very, very good at it, dyslexia didn't ever bother me there. For me, it was more numerically and processing facts, very hard, cold facts would never engage me and would just float over my head. And one thing I think I've learned from my own experiences, if something is going to hold my attention, I need to be able to see it. There needs to be a context. For example, algebra was just an anathema to me, because I needed always a why. Why is it that? I would admire people who could understand that X equals Y because of C or you know, whatever that means. But I would sit there thinking, but who was X in the first place?
Yes.
And I would be totally thrown by this because this is the way my mind works. I'm a very creative, imaginative person. So that's what I've done with Stave House. Everything with Stave House has a context. It's not just a cold fact. It's not this is this because, or when you see this, do this. This is, for example, I'll show you. This is Father Crotchet. He is a very cool, laid-back character. He goes for a walk, walk, walk. That's his pulse. So immediately we've gone from a black note with a stick saying, right, when you see that, clap one, or clap tar, or clap, I don't know, fly, so something totally random. We've got a little chap that does something. He actually goes for a walk. So we can explore that. Where is he going? Is he going to the park? So I realized that the way I learned the best was if I could see it, if I could envisage it. And I do think this really appeals to my dyslexic students. I take the cold facts and we make them into something tangible and real that actually have a purpose. And I think the dyslexics I meet, they're so musical and so creative. They want this creative kind of engagement with what they're doing, which is why they do so well at music. What people don't understand is the cold, hard facts of these black notes go like this. That often, the process of that is difficult. So I've gone back and I've undone that for them because that is the way I learn.
So we're here to really hear your dyslexia story as a teacher, looking back over 40 years of teaching and seeing students with dyslexia. So like, when were you... What was your first wake-up call to dyslexia itself and a student with dyslexia? And you go, oh, my goodness, is this dyslexia affecting music? And when did you start? What was your wake-up call that joined those two dots for you?
I would say very early on in my teaching career, I began to recognize dyslexic students. That they would struggle a lot more to process the notation. They often have slightly more coordination difficulties if they're trying to play the piano, sending the messages to separate hands, that there are, it would be counting as well, perhaps, you know, just working out the beats. But mostly it's hit me when I've been getting students ready for theory exams. I know that the formal theory papers are the big turnoff for dyslexic students because they're long questions that have about three or four elements to them. And the dyslexic processing mind will often miss a crucial element. They just don't see it or they don't remember it. So I was finding that there were students I would think, I know that they know this, but I dare not sit them for a formal written exam because I just know they won't see what the question is saying because in perhaps the anxiety or just sometimes it's too many instructions all at once. And I could see that children that I had that should be flying, if I sat them down, I've got some students now, I'll sit with them on a theory paper and we'll have a look. And they'll immediately miss several elements of the question, even though we've only just spoken about it a minute ago. You know, and I think it's these words kind of flying at them. And they try very hard to think, what is it I'm supposed to do? So I saw it, you know, very, very, very early on. You could just see these struggles. And I came up time and time again, people on the phone saying, my daughter's so musical, but her teacher wants her to carry on. She can't go any higher than grade 5 because she doesn't have a grade 5 theory exam. What can I do? And she doesn't understand it, you know, or he doesn't understand it. And this is happening a lot. People ringing me and saying, what can I do? My child is going to give up because it's too hard. They hate it. And children who should be enjoying music were coming to me because they were stopping enjoying music. And I think the most important thing about being a musician is the love for music, and you know, not a career, not getting into the right school, not any of those things. The most important thing is that you love your music and you can get as high as you want. So yeah, I've seen it a lot.
Well, I mean, what's really motivated me to bring you onto the podcast, Ruth, is that I'm just waking up to this myself, you know, like I'm, you know, we're at podcast 112 or 13 right now, and we've never talked about music. And, you know, it's very easy to just overlook where dyslexia can affect. And, you know, I'd really love to explore this more in depth. So I'm going to be the parent or the person who doesn't know much about this. And maybe you've had this conversation over and over again with many other parents, but I want to have that conversation, have it on the podcast so parents can hear it. So I'm going to ask some pretty obvious stuff to you maybe, but what woke me up to it was that one of the students that we have in Bullet Map Academy, we teach children how to organize their thoughts visually using mind mapping to finish projects and get writing done and presentations done and essays and exams done. Well, one of them said to me recently, and she's a grade five, I won't name her, but she's a grade five. And she said, I've stopped feeling the music. And I want to feel the music. I want to feel, it used to take me away somewhere where I wasn't before, you know, and she's in her own words describing, you know, this young person, you know, what the music is doing for her and why she's playing it. And now she stopped feeling the music because everything is so much more, you know, concentrating on the theory and the score and so on. And there's an invisible barrier showing up here. And you mentioned grade five. Is there something special about grade five? Is that some sort of threshold where things change? Can you give us a quick overview of the grades? Because Americans may not understand this. A lot of Americans listen to this, a lot of Australians. But could you give, we're in the UK here. I'm in Scotland. Ruth is down in England. What overview of the grades, where the key pain points are with dyslexia?
Sure. I will say that there are syllabuses now where, for example, the London College of Music has what they call, it's called a recital grade syllabus, where you just perform pieces and you don't need grade five theory to continue on to grade six with that recital syllabus. So there is a way forward. However, still many parents will say to me that I would like him to have his grade five theory. And classically, when I was training, you could go up to grade five practically, really, and take no theory exams at all. So many teachers would just teach kids practically, and they would not be teaching them theory, which is actually the other thing I do with Stave House. We do it right from the start. We actually learn to read and write music before we really start playing particularly well. But a lot of teachers would sideline this. Then they get to grade five. And then if you wanted to continue to grade six, you can't unless you can present a grade five theory. You would have to give proof of a certificate to say that you are qualified in grade five theory in order to proceed to the higher, what we would call the more advanced grades six, seven, and eight. And there's a reason for that, because theory is like the highway code for drivers. You know, you could keep roaring around in a car and you could do wonderful things in your car, but actually, if you were going to drive well and understand any roadmap, you need the highway code. And theory is the highway code for musicians. So if you want a job as a musician, of course you can get by. There are people who gig in pubs all the time, you know, making a wonderful career without theory, but most of us know that at the baseline we do need it. We need to understand, in order to open a music book and interpret it well, we need to know what it's telling us. So there is a wall still if you don't have any theory knowledge. So that's what the wall is, and it happens at grade five. You can either stop or you can go on.
Right. That's fascinating. And what's the equivalent in America? Do they have the same thing in America? Do you know?
I honestly don't know about the Americans. I have no knowledge.
Well, if you're in America and you've got experience of this, you're the American equivalent of Ruth, or, you know, get in touch with us and we'll get you on the podcast and hear from your perspective.
I do have some American stave house teachers, and I was training one literally this week, and he was saying he was at the Juilliard, and he's played with a lot of orchestras, but he said that he wishes that he had learned to sight read much, much earlier as a child, because he had to work so hard at it as an adult. And had he have done the theory and the sight reading ongoing as a child, life would have been so much easier for him. And he's American.
Okay, so you mentioned Suzuki, okay?
Yeah.
Let's just take Suzuki as a kind of embodiment of a principle.
Okay.
And then, so, you know, my limited understanding of Suzuki, very limited from one student, is that it's a way of playing music by ear in a systematic way to get proficient to high quality level of playing without having to worry about reading music. Is that correct?
Basically, yes. I think that's a good sum up. It's finger numbers. A 1 2 2 1 2 3 3. You know, you sing the numbers over. You know, you sing. The problem with that is number one on the violin is not number one on the trumpet, and it's not number one on the piano. So already you can only play the violin. Whereas if you know what the note is, it's a B. You can say, I know it's a B. And I know it's two beats long. How do I make that on the cello? How do I make that on the bassoon? Because I know what it is. If you only know it as finger number one, it's only finger number one on the instrument you have in your hand.
Okay, so what I can see from the Suzuki method, my limited understanding, so please forgive me, musicians and music teachers out there that are listening, is that often the first exercise you have to practice 100 times.
Yeah, twinkle,
and,
twinkle, A, A, E, E,
1, 1, E. I completely love that idea for one main reason with dyslexia, because people with dyslexia often have a difficulty with automaticity. For us to build a habit takes about 3 to 5 times as long. And often we quit when other people should have got it, you know, we've just tried it 20, 30, 40 times. Most people, you try it 15, 20 times, it becomes a habit. You know, you try it about 40 times, it becomes a habit. 40 days of doing something to form a habit. Dyslexia, you're talking 100 days to form that habit. And that's the difference. And sometimes people realize, I can never form a habit. Oh, yes, you can. But because your automaticity is different because of the dyslexic trait, which comes with advantages, because it means you're very good at improvising, you don't get into automatic habits, but it comes with the disadvantage of that it takes you longer to form a habit. So if you choose a habit and you choose to make it a habit and you spend the 100 repetitions, 100's an arbitrary number, but let's just than 40, basically, or more than 25, then you have a habit that you want and is good. So I love it for that. And I love some other traits in the Suzuki method, but we're talking here, our focus is reading music, okay?
Yeah.
We're not talking about teaching music as a whole, but this whole podcast is this challenge of learning to read music. Often in the podcast, I ask people, what was life like before dyslexia? What was your wake-up call? We've got the wake-up call, which was early on. You started to see this difficulty in the reading of music. And then we're talking about the challenge itself. Let's zoom in on this challenge of learning to read music. So we've identified when the pain point is, often at grade 5. And often in the early years, you just go, oh, this is difficult. So let's just leave it to the side and go down the area that you're good at and build up your confidence and ability, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about how you met that challenge of reading music.
Interestingly, I use exactly what you're saying, which is a lot of repetition, because stave house in the ideal world, is introduced to children at three. And at 3 years old, we take them to our music house, but we sing songs, because I always say to people, why?
Before you carry on, forgive me for interrupting you, but for the listeners, explain to them what Stave House is. Is it a physical location? Is it
a
program?
I'm just about to show you.
What is it? Yeah.
So this is Stave House. And the reason it's called Stave House is because I think it's really important that children use correct terminology, you know, whatever we're talking about. So this is the musical stave. It's called a stave.
For the listeners, could you do a verbal description of what you're showing to me on the screen?
And it's a board. I've got a magnetic board here, and it has the symbol of the treble clef to the side, which I tell the children is the treble clef plant, and it's growing in the garden. So it gives it a purpose. And it's because they're going to learn, if they're going to compose music, they always start nearest the treble clef plant so that they have the left to right structure.
So it grows away from the plant. It grows out from the...
going away.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we've got five lines and four spaces, but I call them rooms. So we actually go to the rooms, and the rooms are the first thing of Stave House that the children meet. We bring our eye to the rooms. And in the same way, when I was growing up, we sang lots of songs in the playground. You know, the farmer's in his den. We all know these songs. We didn't learn them. We literally did what you're saying. We repeated. So our children sing, "Here is a house with four rooms, the song has begun. Can you see who I can see living in number?" And they already know that they're going to say one. They already know this song. And I'll tell you who it is. I introduce them to, and listeners who can't see it, I'm picking up a little round magnet. And it's a little round magnet with a picture of a fox on. So it's round because it's actually a note. So it's a note character, and his name is Ferdy the Fox. And the reason it's Ferdy is so that the children can feel the sound F with their mouths. So it's very, it's about language as well. It's not Freddy, because it's not the note FR, because that's going to be confusing. It's Ferdy, and his note sound is going to become the note F. And they sing about the four characters that live in the room. So for several weeks, they are forming a habit. They are habit forming by going and they're singing this song. Here is a house with four rooms. And they're joining in and they're placing the four different characters that go in this room. So for a dyslexic student, they've met some engaging characters. They're physically holding them in their hand. So they're going to place Elaine the elephant at the top of the house. Imagine having an elephant at the top of your house. You know, this is quite amusing. So we begin to introduce these characters, and you can see that because she is at the top of the house, I can talk to the children about high notes, because high is a concept that children don't have.
I get you. So you've got an A3 board in front of you that's magnetic.
Yeah.
We've got the stave on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
And then we've got those five lines.
Yeah.
And that's the house.
Yeah.
And then you've got four rooms. Are they like on four levels? Is that like...
They're on four levels.
Level
that's
one,
right.
Level two,
yeah.
Level three.
Yeah.
So the fourth level of the house
is up, is high.
Is high.
And the people
and then low.
That yes. So that they are getting an idea of visual pitch.
Got you. Yes.
In time. So I can say, do you think Elaine is a high sounding note or a low sounding note? And the child will know that they can tell me the answer because she is at the top of the house. So she is going to sound high. So, you know, for sight singers, they can begin to guess where those notes are going to be.
They just guess a little bit more accurately. I know,
exactly,
I know,
yeah.
The elephant is up at the top of the house somewhere.
Exactly.
It might not be
yeah.
right at the top, but it's somewhere up the top. And then gradually they get more and more.
Exactly.
Okay, I like
Whereas
it. Keep coming.
Dunstan the dragon lives under the ground.
Oh, I see.
Dark cave. So he's down below. So we play these games and we sing things like, whose name, whose name, whose name begins with, whose name begins with the note sound E. Elaine the elephant. So we're actually helping spell. There's a lot of language going on with this, but we begin to connect the names Elaine, Amos, Dunstan the dragon, Ferdy the fox, with the note sound E, A, and whatever they're going to be. And it's not long before we can meet some rhythm characters. I showed you for Father Crotchet. We have Father Crotchet, who goes for a walk. So he can walk over to Dunstan the Dragon's cave. So when he visits Dunstan the Dragon, the children learn the note sound they're going to choose out of their chime bar set or on the piano or on whatever they're playing. The note sound is the note D for Dunstan, and they're going to play walk on it. Walk, 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 walk. However, if Uncle Semibreve comes to visit Dunstan, and Uncle Semibreve is a very round, empty circle note, he has an empty tummy, he has to eat four big meals a day, and he's still not full up. He says, wait for two, three, four, because he can't move very fast. If he visits Dunstan, it's still the same note, but it's longer, D for two, three, four. So the children learn that they can choose their note sounds. They can choose how long they're going to be. And it's not long before we can start playing matching games. Sometimes composers don't have enough time to draw our proper notes. They have to do a quick version.
Which is a black dot with a stick because they're in a hurry.
So they, you know, obviously Beethoven's Fifth should have been drawn with beautiful crotchets, but he just didn't have time. So he just made his own quick version of them.
Okay, fantastic.
And so the kids can, we can play matching games. We can turn them over. Have you got a match for Father Crotchet? Yes, I have. And they can begin to see this is what he looks like. And really, it's so amazing. We take them down into the bass clef ocean so that they go under the sea. They go to alto clef bay, so they read in different clefs. We visit the key signature cafe. Everything they need for really complex theory, we do with these people.
Ruth, I really like that approach. I have a sort of little phrase that I keep saying to myself is find the creative logic.
Okay.
And so for me with dyslexia, I need something creative, but not just arbitrarily creative, but has some real logic to it.
Yes.
So, you know, the fat one with the hole in his tummy has four empty meals, four meals a day to fill it, and it doesn't fill him up. There's a creative logic to that. So it's creative. I can visualize him and the empty tummy and the logic with the four and then the logic of the four beats. There's real creative logic encoded in that. That what I like about that is that although it seems childish, it's not childish, it's childlike.
Yes.
But the thing I remember at law school when I did a law degree, and one of my genius law professors, we all called him the genius. And you can tell the difference between someone who's excellent and someone who's actually a genius, because the genius always takes the complex and makes it simply understandable without dumbing it down.
Yes.
And that's what you're doing. You're taking the complex and making it simply understandable without dumbing it down. You're still retaining the integrity of the discipline of the music.
Yes.
So that once you take away all of that creativity, what you're left with is that intellectual distilled
That's right.
logic that is written music.
It will grow up with you.
Yes.
So Ferdy the Fox becomes F, Father Crotchet becomes the Crotchet. He goes for a walk. Every time you see him, you can clap him. Mother Minim says, wait, because she never rushes. So, you are moving into these complex things. And believe it, Stave House has four levels. And I have music grads who come on the course and go, oh my God, why didn't anyone teach me it like this? And the light goes on for them in so many ways, because everything is in context. And it literally grows up with you. And what I didn't want was a fun, sugary little method that was sweet and fun. But then someone would say, oh, but now we have to do it properly, unfortunately.
Yes.
That will never happen with Stave House. It just beautifully transfers into the real thing. And before long, you can match it, you can take a piece of music and say, so can you see Father Crotchet in this music? You can. Who's he visiting? That's right, he's visiting Amos the Ant. So that's A, who's this? It's still Amos, but it's Mother Minim. And they can begin to analyze exactly what they need. And we get to a point where we'll say, put on the board the different note sounds you can see in this music, the different ones. And the child will go along and, oh my word, only actually four different people. It's a huge big piece of music. But actually, when I break it down, put my characters on the board, there's only actually different sounds in this piece of music.
So yes, fascinating.
It keeps breaking it down.
Yeah, and you're distilling it so you can actually conceptualize it rather than just this blur of...
Yeah, this huge, my word, this looks awful. It's like, well, hang on a minute. Let's just deconstruct it together.
Yes.
So we teach them to do that right from the word go so that they can do it for themselves.
Have you heard of... I don't know if you've... I've got a little explanation of dyslexia that I call the difference between a manual car and an automatic car. I don't know if you've heard of it yet.
I haven't.
No. So, and you could maybe apply this to music, okay? So that's why I'm bringing it up. So often people with dyslexia, when you get a dyslexia assessment, you're told you're a slow processor.
Right.
When it comes to decoding words, when it comes to decoding movement, you're a slow processor in movement. So you're dyspraxic. You're a slow processor with numbers. So you're dyscalculic. Mm. You're a slow processor with words and general processes, dyslexic, etc. So how do you understand slow processing? Because we think of processors as computer chips. You know, like if you've got a slow processor in your computer, then your computer is slow.
Right. Okay. But I wouldn't think that. I would applaud a slow processor.
Okay, interesting. But in this analogy with my daughter, for example, often young people think of processors and computers and being slow. How do I change? What it's actually like is the difference between a manual Ferrari and an automatic Ferrari. You've got a powerful engine, but your gearbox is different. Your processing is the gearbox. So some people automatically process, automatically go up the gears, and other people are manual and they have to choose to go into first, second, third, fourth, fifth. Some people even have manual gearboxes that are 18 gears, like a truck has 18 gears to get up to 70 miles an hour. And so a lot of people get stuck in first gear with dyslexia all their lives, and they just rev the engine and get up to 60 or 70 miles an hour, and they find that they're exhausted or overheating, but they're getting it done, but they don't understand why. They know they've got a powerful engine, but there's something stopping them getting up to top speed. And what you're doing here is you're breaking down the gears, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, etc. But there's a key element in the car between the two, and that's the clutch. There's an extra pedal in the car of a dyslexic mind, and that pedal is the clutch. And often, not always, that clutch is your way of thinking, and often it's creativity, visualization, kinesthetic, or movement. And to go from one gear to the other, you need to engage that activity of visualizing it as a person or a character, or in a relative location, dimensionally, etc., or in movement. And once you've done that, you get disengage and move into the next gear, and then you press it again, you move into the next gear. And that's what you're doing here, breaking it down not just into gear steps, but you're bringing that link, which is the clutch that connects it from one to the other.
The reason I said I would applaud a slow process is actually because then we have the mastery.
We have the mastery of
quick through processes. We'll go shortcut. Here I am. It's like, well, how did you get there? Do you understand the foundation of why you got there? And it's like, no, I just know the answer. And that's all very well. But us, the creative slow processes, we have the mastery of our profession. We have the mastery of what we're doing. And that's what I want to impart, is musical mastery. And I think it's by going that lovely slow process. But yeah, I hadn't thought about being stuck in that first gear. And that's what we're offering here with Stave House, is don't be stuck. Let's move you up. And actually, you'll probably end up far more knowledgeable than all those fast processes.
Yeah, and many racing car drivers would much prefer driving a manual Ferrari on the racetrack, so they know exactly when they go into
what
third gear, down to second, up to sixth, or whatever it is, at the right point, in the right turn, rather than leaving it to the automatic unconscious response. And so that is, okay, it might take 4 or 5 times as long to become proficient at something, but in that practice, you get the mastery. And you don't just get the mastery. Well, another way of expressing mastery is that intentionality and that consciousness of what you're doing.
Yes.
And once you've got that consciousness of what you're doing, you actually can often find variations that are better at doing certain things, or better transitions, or whatever it is, because you're having to be a much more intentional person.
Yeah. And for the future, you know, kids at the moment in school, they're taught a lot of answers. Well, those questions won't even be relevant in 5 to 10 years. So the people that can process and slowly, methodically work out and analyze for themselves what they're doing, they will be able to cope with anything new in the future, because they'll be prepared for the slow working of the cogs. Whereas I think a lot of people I meet now in schools, they just want the answer. Google, the answer. And parents are happy with that. Oh, it's great. Let's tick off, you know, that's lovely. We've got all these grades. It's like, well, how much of that do they actually understand? And how much of that are they going to use? So by using our processes, I think we're equipping the children far more for life in the future, whether they're dyslexic or not.
Yes, absolutely. So, Ruth, you said to me before this interview, you weren't sure if you were dyslexic or not. You might be mildly dyslexic. Let's put you through our dyslexia quiz.
I'm beginning to think, Darius, that maybe the whole reason I devised Stave House is because I am dyslexic.
Let's see. So this quiz is kind of a dyslexia quiz. It kind of analyzes through just dyslexic traits. If you've got half of these dyslexic traits, you're probably dyslexic. It's not like everyone who's got dyslexia has all of these traits. That these processing differences come up in different ways. So you just join the dots. So let's join a few dots here, and let's see if you've got how many dyslexic traits you've got, shall we?
Sure, yes.
Okay, let's start this quiz. And if you want to see this quiz, just go to Dyslexia Quiz on the Apple Store and you'll find it. It's free currently anyway. So let's put the audio on.
I can quiz different people for you. Who is it going to be this time?
Can you hear that recorded audio?
I can, yes, I can.
Okay, so I'm going to click friend.
What's the name of the person taking the quiz?
So what we've got here is some writing, a doodle, and speaking, because we wanted to make it multisensory. And click Ruth, continue.
Great. Let's quiz you on the signs of dyslexia in reading. Do you find it hard to read?
Now, before you do this, Ruth, I want you to imagine you're answering these questions as a 10 or 12-year-old.
Sure. Okay.
So we'll do the 10 or 12 year old score.
So I go back to how I felt at 10.
Yes. Would you answer yes, no, or sometimes to these? You can also do this quiz again as the adult version and as an adult and answer them. And sometimes you'll be saying yes and sometimes you'll be saying no because you've learned different skills.
Sure.
But let's just concentrate on school. Okay.
Yeah.
So do you find it hard to read?
No.
No.
Do you tend to read slower than your friends?
No, very fast.
Do you get stressed when you read aloud to others?
No.
Do you skip words when you read?
I skim read, but I.
You're doing it by choice?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll say no.
Do you reread sentences and paragraphs a lot?
No.
Do you prefer to listen to a book rather than read it?
No.
Do you learn a spelling and forget it the next week?
No, I'm good at spelling.
Do you tend to overcomplicate long written questions?
Possibly.
Sometimes.
Do you tend to forget what you just read?
No.
Do you often struggle with comprehension? Do you tend to forget what you just read?
Depends on the kind of reading. If it's a story, no. If it's a manual, yes.
Okay, so we'll go for sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Do you often struggle with comprehension tests?
This is the advert for Stave House for the podcast. So if you like this podcast and Ruth's style of teaching, I really want to recommend a course that she has for you to do as a family at home. It's kind of like going on a musical adventure and learning to read basic notes and rhythm while getting to know the wonderful characters that live up on the stave that she was describing. Stave House basically lays musical foundations that's taught through visual, tactile, an auditory approach. This includes storytelling, role-playing, singing games, rhymes, teaching creativity, inspiring curiosity. And as you've learned, you know, it's really helpful for children with dyslexia to actually learn the core of learning how to read music. It's called the Complete Children's Home Course Level 1. And your child can join in with Ruth Travers online and learn at your own pace for over a year. And the course covers all requirements for the London College of Music accredited Stave House Level 1 Award. And it's only £120. So you also get a set of interactive magnetic boards to learn with. And if you want to know more about this course, head over to stavehouse.co.uk. The link's provided in the show notes below. This product's currently available in the UK and the USA and other places. But if you want to purchase it outside of the UK, please email info@stavehouse.co.uk and they'll discuss the best way to arrange postage because it costs more. They're based in the UK, of the magnetic board. So thank you. I hope this is of interest to you. I wouldn't recommend it unless I thought it was really good. And actually, I think that's a little bit too cheap, but it's a good deal. So back to the show.
Great. Thanks, you. Thank you.
Great.
Hey, well done. This is your score.
So, Ruth, here's your score. And what does it say? For those of you who are listening, you can tell that all of the first phase of reading and writing were well in the sort of no section, and you're not showing the typical traits of dyslexia in your reading and writing. But you are showing it in the area of the remembering. You're in the kind of dyslexia zone for the tests and the memory and then the planning, you know, at the end there, lots of yeses. So this is a 63, which says your work is not impacted by dyslexia.
Yeah.
So it's not a typical dyslexic profile, but what it's showing is you've got some of the executive functioning difficulties that come with dyslexia. So there's this area of, so dyslexia and ADD overlap in this middle area of executive functioning, which is the planning, the organizing, the remembering, all of that sort of you know.
It's really, really interesting. And you see, and I would do brilliantly at things that I loved, that like maths, geography. I would sit in the lessons and I would listen so hard. And yet actually it would just go over my head. You can, and my husband, well, he's kind of helped enormously as I've got older to organize myself, but he's had to really kind of train me to, you know, to remember to take, you know, hang the keys back up when I come in.
Yes.
Things like that. And you were talking about projects. Now, some projects will totally grab me and I'll just be so involved with them. Others will totally overwhelm me. And I was trying to remember as a child, you know, I was doing that as a child, not now. And, you know, the bag made me laugh because I can remember at 6 years old, at the end of term, I could hardly walk home because I had about five bags, all full of things, because I could never remember to take the bag home. So the next day I would take another bag and another bag, you know, because, and it was, and I think the one thing we all, you know, want to share is how misunderstood we are as
yes.
people, because people will tell us off, you're so disorganized, why didn't you remember that? And you're kicking yourself. You think, I don't know, you know, I don't know why I didn't remember it. I wish I had, but I just couldn't.
Yes.
And I think as a child, I definitely suffered from that. And, you know, it's really quite interesting. And how cross people get with you. But, you know, I've told you this. I've told you how the car works.
Yeah.
You know, I've run you through how all these, you know, how all this works. It's like, yeah, but I just cannot remember where the indicator is. Yeah, you know, I'm really sorry. I just have no idea how to get out of this car. And, you know, so,
yes.
I think it's things like that that people do get very frustrated with us and think, and I know that one teacher did actually say to my mother, I don't know why Ruth is so terrible at math. She's so good at English. It's like, it's ridiculous. Why is she so bad at this? Because she's so good in this area. And I think it's marvelous that now that there is so much more chat about different aspects of dyslexia, you know, that people. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that Ruth, you've got some sort of different way of processing and an assessment would identify whether it's dyscalculia and executive function. I would make a guess at dyscalculia, maybe even dyspraxia, ironically, you know, like movement.
Although my movements and coordination is really good.
Who knows? I think knows, an expert would show, but what's showing up is the executive function big time, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting,
but
isn't it?
Sometimes what's interesting also in this kind of profile is there's a form of dyslexia, stealth dyslexia, where what happens is it's kind of like everyone's a typical car and you're a Ferrari, but you're stuck in first gear. So you can still go 60 miles an hour. You can still do the reading. You can still do the writing. You can still, on the face of it, on the outside, do everything that everyone else does, but you're still a manual processor. You're still dyslexic. Do you see what I mean? So there's a ton of people who are dyslexic, but they don't show up the typical traits. But you do an educational psychologist profile and you look at how high their intelligence is. You look at their processing speed, their working memory speeds, all these other metrics, and you compare them and you go, my goodness, yes, okay, you're being throttled down to a typical intelligence level because of these processing difficulties or differences. But if you knew about them and you knew what to do about them, you would actually raise to the level of intelligence you've actually got because you can get up to gear, basically.
Yeah. It's interesting, though. And who knows, if I hadn't have got those traits, I wouldn't have developed Stave House in the way that I have.
Yes, you've definitely got traits and you've got those difficulties that so many other people with dyslexia have got. It's not the reading side. It's that, you know, the processing of the notes and the rhythms and the order and the sequencing and all of that is executive function difficulties that come with dyslexia a lot of the time. And you're addressing them. And I think it's because you've got those similar difficulties.
I think it must be. It's really fascinating. And I do deal with a lot of music teachers who actually they hang on to some of the concepts by the, you know, the seat of their pants. They don't really know why they know those things. And they'll come on a Stave House training course and it will be as though the lights go on, because I have deconstructed the information for them in a way that no one ever has. And I think it's possibly because I need it deconstructed myself. You know, I never had any trouble reading music, never. It was something that came so naturally to me. But I think it's the way I like to learn, is to really understand. So I've totally applied that to teaching other people how to do it. And I think that's why it works so well for dyslexic people. And you were saying about the trite sort of simplicity of it. You know, we can have, I've had a lovely 14-year-old student, and we talked about the bending stresses, you know, that perhaps had to have in order
Ruth,
to
Ruth, you it. Broke up there. You had a 14-year-old student. And
yes. I was talking about, you know, the simplicity of the characters, but actually we can have lots of fun with them. He said to me, why is the elephant at the top of the house? You know, what about the bending stresses of the house? And we were talking sort of physics and sort of fun things, even though we were using the character and this very childish element. We still made it very teenage and very senior, you know.
Yes, yes.
And so actually it doesn't patronize in any way.
Do you ever get the children to draw the house with the as a house with the levels and
I mean, most of them have their own boards, Darius. Most of them have their own little set at home so they can move them around. We encourage them to have the songs at home and the board to play with, and they can learn an instrument with it, or they can do it with tune percussion with a little set of chime bars. They can draw it, but it's probably more fun to have the actual magnetic characters to move around.
One of the things that I've got in my mind is, we've got four rooms in the house.
Yes.
But what happens in between the rooms? Are they rooms as well? What are the lines?
So the lines are a ladder. And we meet the note builder, who is essentially the landlord at Stave House. And he comes along. Here he is. I'll get him for you. He's a little bit like Bob the builder, isn't he?
Bob the builder. Okay, got you. Right, okay.
We call him the note builder.
The note builder. Okay, the builder.
And so the note builder comes and he puts his ladder up against the house and he jumps on the bottom rung of the ladder and he says, oh, it's easy, easy standing on the bottom rung. It's easy. It's
easy.
And you can think, hang on, we've had E. We have. But where did she live? She lived in the top room. So
okay.
She was a high E. He is a low E.
Oh.
At the bottom of the ladder. Then he goes up a little bit. Ah, it's getting harder because it's getting higher. Getting harder, getting higher. G, G. Up he goes again. He bangs the nails in, bangs the nails in one by one. He bangs. So he says it's easy. Then it's getting, he's getting higher. He bangs, he decorates delightfully on rung number four. Then he's at the top. Finish off the roof, finish off the roof. So we sing this lovely song. We make a ladder on the floor and the children climb the ladder. And it's like, where does he bang? Ooh, quick, down the ladder, number three. They can actually physically do this in the classroom.
Oh. Well,
easy, down here. So then we can start saying, where's high F? Where he finishes. Where's G? G. Getting there. Where does he decorate? High D. So they start playing with the ladder as well as the characters in between.
Okay.
Then we can start talking about high and low. So you've got low D, Dunstan the dragon under the ground. High D, decorate on the ladder. So the note builder does things that begin with the note sound.
Okay.
So we have got loads and loads of other characters. So we've got characters and then the note builder does an activity that begins with the note sound.
Fascinating. Okay.
And then we have middle C. We have our C searcher, the middle C.
Yeah, what the middle C is so important in music in general. So where does middle C fit in this story?
So Dunstan is a dragon who goes traveling in his old-fashioned submarine, a bit like, you know, was it 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea or whatever? It's one of those old-fashioned submarines. And it floats there, ready to splash down in the Bass Clef Ocean.
Oh, so the sea is halfway between the land and the ocean.
That's right. And then we go down. We can change our board. We have a Bass Clef that goes on this board, or we can put two boards. So the children can then travel down into the Bass Clef Ocean as far down below as they can go, A, F, D, B, G. And then they find sea creatures on the way down. And we have lovely songs about going into the Bass Clef Ocean. And
so where can people learn about all of this? How does it all work? Do they have to come and be tutored by you, or do they, how does it work?
Stave House runs training for teachers. So we facilitate training for teachers, and schools can buy into Stave House and teach Stave House's online training. So they can just buy the video training and work with me, and they get an they can be assessed in level one, level two, they can get up to level four. There's a diploma, teaching diploma in Stave House. Parents can get a home course. There's the little Stave House home course, which takes them through level one, that includes some chime bars, and we'll get them, you know, working with the treble clef. So
what do they do? The parents, do they go online to your website?
Yes, go to stavehouse.co.uk.
We'll put that in the, everything that Ruth has mentioned is in the show notes down below. Just swipe up and you'll see all the writing. Whichever app you're in, there'll be writing in there, show notes with some links for that Ruth will provide. So they go we'll put in different links for different things. So if you're a parent, you go there. What does it cost to get a package like that?
I'm just thinking what the little home costs. The it's terrible, isn't it? Full training, if you wanted to be a Stave House teacher, you're talking probably about £300, £400 to get right through the levels. It's £200 a level if you want to study and become a Stave House teacher and make a career of that. For a school, you can buy the equipment and have a teacher trained, and you can have a license that allows you to have as many teachers as you want teaching the method. They just have to invest in one, you know, some training for the school and a sort of school classroom set. Parents, I think the home course, it's not very much. That's terrible, isn't it? I should know.
We'll have a look on the website. So yeah, it gives listeners that seems very reasonable.
It's under, you know, it's under 50 quid for it. It's less, I mean, you know, it's sort of
this is
to do it at
fantastic.
Home.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's great. Great. We'll put links in the description below for that. Ruth, it's been fantastic hearing your story. There's just so much more to talk about here. Like, I want to ask you about software, for example.
Right.
And also I want to ask you about mind mapping. One of the key things we ask everyone is, what's mind mapping been in their journey? Do you know about it? Have you done it? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Have you heard of mind mapping?
I have heard about mind mapping, and I think I understand it in a very sort of low key way. Just run me by how sort of it's about having sort of almost stations in your mind, isn't it, to get to a point.
That's right. That's a way of doing it. Yes. So you start off with a central concept in the middle of the page, and then you have you work in clockwise order. So at 1 o'clock, you put an idea in there and it's on a branch, and you branch off ideas from it. And then round about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, you put another one, and 6 o'clock, and all the way around. And you've got this constellation of ideas all connected to each other. And as you get more ideas, you can put them in different places and you can grow this tree of thoughts out the way. And we do that a lot in Bullet Map Academy, except most people with dyslexia have very random thoughts. So we don't we don't grow from the middle out. We tend to grow from the out in. So we have this cloud of thoughts that we pull together. We have a bullet map process, which is you mind dump all your ideas as a bullet point list, find the big ideas and start constructing it from the inside and adding it out, so that it's not just a random chaotic you know, spider diagram of thoughts. Anyway, so it's interesting to hear. It's not been much on your radar. Let's move on. Apps, you know, like I've got a hunch, okay? And it's fascinating here because you've gone down the very manual route, slow, breaking it down. It's not abstract. It's very physical, creative, multisensory.
I think that's because music essentially is a tactile subject.
Yes.
And I know that the children, I'm a very much a see, hear, do, like involve more senses than just looking. So that's why I've remained. We could have gone just online. We've got smart board materials for classroom if they want it. But I always advocate that's really just a backup, because the key learning for me, I believe, especially with small children, is that they handle these things, they feel them, they move them, they engage.
It is so, so helpful.
So, so important.
It is.
To do that.
And we don't understand completely what's going on in our minds, but I think that physical movement is rewriting our neural pathways and reorganizing things in our mind that we have to physically do it to organize it and experience it.
It's why I've kept the boards, because the children physically place Elaine at the top. They're not just, you know, looking at her going up there on a computer program. They are physically putting her there. Therefore, their action is up. They are feeling that. So we
find that with bullet map, you know, a different discipline, but similar principles. You know, we are manually asking someone to write down a list, to draw a doodle, to color something in, to construct some picture of what they're thinking. So you're physically moving, you're using your imagination, you're using words, you're connecting things. There's movement in terms of positioning and all of that jazz. So,
yes.
But the question I'm going to move this on to is, I've also noticed that as you get more proficient in reading music, is there not some utility in things like, for example, where you get these computer programs where you've got the music on it and it moves the cursor along, the bar, the line along, the placement line, and then it plays the note and the note changes or whatever. You know, there's something about that where you're seeing it, you're hearing it, and someone is placing where your eye should be that, you know, is there a place for that, do you think, in the training process that you've experienced yourself? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
I do know exactly what you mean. I mean, if I'm writing music, I use Sibelius, for example, and that has that facility. It will play back to me. I'm glad I learned to do everything that I can do without it. Because, you know, in my day, you had to hear it all in your head, which is a fantastic skill to have as a musician. And I do think it can replace some of your inherent skills if you're not careful. But there is a place for it. Whether you'd want to play along to music so strictly in time that it doesn't give you room actually for self-expression, that's the trouble with these tick, 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 tick playing along. There's no room then for emotion. There's no room for, you know, slowing up, you know, giving your almost your body music to what you're doing. I think you have to be careful, but of course there's a place for it, and maybe it keeps your eye where you're going. So I think computer programs speed up. You know, I use them all the time when I'm writing music. I use computer programs. I don't use them to put music in there that I haven't thought of myself. There's a danger. I've marked a lot of O-level and A-level music where kids have just randomly chosen instruments that actually they know nothing about, and they'll give them notes that they couldn't physically play, because, you know, they've just thought, oh, I'll give this to the flute, you know, and they'll write this part. You think, well, you know, it would be a miracle if the flute could actually play that note, but it's actually only very short. There's a danger, and I think you need to understand your craft and use the computer technology.
Thank you. That's a great answer.
Yeah.
That's a great answer. Thank you for that.
So teachers can train to do Stave House. Children can do it at home. Use it with any instrument. That's quite important. You can use it with anything.
Okay. Now, one of the things that I've noticed being dyslexic myself coming to music with fresh eyes on behalf of one of my students who's finding the music writing at stage five level, grade five. She can play to grade five on a couple of instruments, but she doesn't know the theory to that stage, even though she's tried very hard. Is that when I looked at the music, I don't understand why the bars should be all the same width. From my point of view, I find it hard to read the rhythm of music. Okay. And so I want to visually see the visual rhythm order mapped out in front of me. That's my ideal. Unfortunately, music is written in such a way that if it's got the four beat note in it, they constrict that bar.
The bar is shorter.
And then another bar is really big because it's got eight notes in it. It would, you know, a dyslexic friendly way of writing music would be all the bars would be exactly the same length because they represent exactly the same
distance
of beat of time. So the time the time is even, you know, it's not expanding or contracting time visually. And then when a music note is placed on in that bar, it's given a position that is relative to its time. So if it's a very small note, it would have a small space. If it's a big note, it would be spaced out bigger. And so you can actually see by the positioning of the notes, the rough rhythm of the music visually, rather than decoding it from that's a crotchet, that's a semi-breve, etc.
Okay, you know, that's quite interesting.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's just my own particular thing, and I've heard that from other people with dyslexia. So it's like the visual logic of it doesn't really, it is kind of being overwritten.
I think you're looking too hard at the bars and the bar lines. The bar lines, it just says you've had enough beats, you've had the right, it's just so you know where to start again on count number one. So the length of the bars are not important. If you see a semi-breve, uncle semi-breve, he goes for two, three, four. Now you can bodily move that. If you're clapping, our kids always clap their rhythm before they play it. So they clap, walk, walk, wait, jogging, jogging, wait for two, three, four. And they bodily feel the length of this rhythm. Therefore, the bar lines don't matter to them. They just know how long those notes are going to be because they're feeling them in their body. Then they play according to the way that feels within them kinesthetically. The bar line just says you've had enough counts. You've had four counts. So here's your next one. And actually, what you're saying is works. If you've got a piano, you would have the right-hand music and the left-hand music written together. So your bars would be the same length because while one hand is playing perhaps four notes of one, the other one is continuing. So it's really, you don't even look at the bar lines. The bar lines just say that's.
But the thing is, what I'm saying is I do look at the bar lines because as a complete novice, I'm using the bar lines and the positions of the notes to try and gauge what the rhythm is without decoding it. So what I would love is a way of visually decoding it at the beginning so I can visually see the rhythm without having to say that's a four beat or whatever. I can see visually that that's realistically a four beat. Okay, I know it's very rudimentary.
I'm making you a pattern here.
Yes. Okay.
Right, so this is a random pattern. It doesn't even fit into a time signature.
You'll need to describe it for the podcast.
So what I'm doing is I'm putting a mixture on my board. I'm putting some rhythmic characters. Some are the level four characters where they're actually standard notation, black and white notes. Some are my little cartoon characters still. I've just got a mixture here. If I gave this to one of our students, they would clap. They would hold their hands together for the first one. It's a dotted minim. We have mother minim and her dog. So mother minim says, wait, when you're learning about minims. Wait, wait, because Father Crotchet's going down the road. Walk, walk, walk. And he hasn't waited for her. And she's still, you know, busy doing her hair. When she's got her little dog with her, it's an extra beat for him. Wait for two, three. So what I've got on the board is I've got a dotted minim, I've got two joined quavers and a crotchet. I've got the cartoon joined quavers again, the crotchet, and I've got Uncle's semibrieve. So my children would clap it like this, and I'll do it with my hands. Wait for two, three, jogging, walk, wait for two, three, four.
Okay.
So they'd get it absolutely right without worrying how long they are or anything. Later on, I could ask them to divide it into counts, but they have a clapping. So they'll see a minim, wait. They just know that that's what she says. They'll see the quavers and go jogging. And so they will play the word that we associate with those rhythmic characters. So they're not really worrying about how it all fits.
Okay, so what I've done here is you've created a hack and I've created a hack, okay? So my hack is I would like the decoding to be done for me visually.
Yeah.
By seeing it, the space, like a block and a little block and a big block and a little block and so on. So whereas you have done the hack via a different route, which is instead of relying on some sort of visual cue of space equals time, it's directly to a creative hack. I know that's Father Crotchet and he does
this
X,
is
Y,
what he
and Z.
Does.
And so it's fascinating because both are hacks, both are trying to, and yours is better than mine because mine's an interim. Which
and
I'm
yours,
with,
yours would
with
have to be rewritten.
Yes, that's what I'm
Whereas
thinking. Yes.
With mine, we can pick up a piece of music that was written in 1950 and we can apply it.
Yes.
Play it. So with my hack, it will work whatever music they look
yes.
at. Your hack, we'd have to rewrite everything.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that's quite interesting in terms of accommodations, okay, for dyslexia. You know, sometimes it's like, what things can we do to accommodate this processing difference? Mm. And there isn't a one size fits all. So there's two types of accommodations. There's an external accommodation, which someone else has to do for you, i.e. rewrite the music so it's in a way that you can decode visually. Or an internal accommodation where I have translated everything that is there into some visual language, creative language, rhythm, music, experience that I can translate it into my way of thinking. So I've created an internal accommodation so that I can deal with
standard music,
situation.
Standard
yes.
music, yeah.
yeah.
See, our kids would play this game in the room. They'd walk like Uncle Semibrieve, holding their tummies. Wait for two, three, four. Who am I being? They walk. And they say, oh, you're being Father Crotchet. So they really really live these characters. They move them, they clap them, they feel them so that when they see them on the page, they've got all this understanding of what that rhythmic character actually does.
So I know we're way over time, but I'm finding this so fascinating.
Sorry.
I'm loving it. And I'm sure the listeners are loving it too. If you're a 14-year-old or 12, an adult, you know, and you go through this, you've got these four stages and you start in this very childlike process and you have to go from the beginning to rebuild all those steps all the way to the top. I'm just wondering, how long does it take to sort of go through this process?
With an adult, it would take hardly any time at all. You know,
give me an idea. So if I'm an adult right now and I want to get to level four,
so
you know,
I'd say don't take yourself too seriously because I'm going to play a funny game with you. I'd probably sing this, you know, show you the characters once or twice and I'd turn them over. And, you know, I'd just get you to place them. And then very quickly, I'd start replacing them with actual notes.
Okay.
You know, we could do that in one lesson with an adult. I've got a lady running, she's played the piano off and on for years but can't read music. So her first lesson, I got the characters out, but within 5-10 minutes, we were replacing them with black and whites, and then we were looking at the music. It's very fast.
Okay, so, you know, we're talking about to build this creative logic behind these cold symbolic notes.
Yeah.
You're warming them up with this creative logic behind the scenes, and then they can hang that on.
Yeah, they can hang it on whatever they want to do. With the children, we take a lot longer because we want them to develop creativity. So we want them to act the characters. We don't just want them reading music. We want them playing, moving, dancing. You know, we want to really build a musical person from the age of 3, really exploring these levels. But with an adult, you can do it in minutes, really. Just go away and...
Yeah, okay. So let's say I spent 4, 5, 6, 7 hours of my time going through the materials and working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could, because I could get up into fourth gear, as it were, in processing music.
You know,
because I think personally I've probably been stuck in first or second when it comes to music, and I can play a saxophone or a tenor recorder or whatever like that, but I find it hard to read the music. And I can read music, but read the beat and so forth. I could find, I'm sold, Ruth. I didn't know much about the system at the beginning, but I really love it. Fantastic.
Thank you. It's taken a long time as well.
How long has it taken to develop process?
Years. Because I'm always learning what else it can do. That's first of all, I just developed, you know, the treble clef, because I was teaching, I was asked to teach Suzuki violin, and I didn't want to because I wanted the children to read music. So it was like, well, they're 3, what can we do? And so we had to go, like, how do children like to learn? They like...
How long ago was that?
So that's like, oh, I would say that's about 1990, you know, when, you know, it's a long time ago. And then I began...
That's 30 years ago.
Yeah, then I put it away. You know, I was traveling, singing, coaching. I didn't do Stave House for about 10 years. And then finally I had a professional cellist come with a beautiful little boy of 4 who was so musically gifted, but so little. And she said, you know, can you do anything with him, Ruth? And I said, you know, I think I've got something in the cupboard that he'd really like. And I got it out and she said, oh, where is this? Like, where has this been? And I hadn't had it. I'd just drawn, you know, cut them out and stuff. And so I think it was about 2006-ish, 2007. Finally, my eldest son said, are you going to do anything with Stave House, Mum? And I said, I don't know. You know, and I redrew all the characters. My husband said, you should just put it all down. And from there, in 2009, London College of Music got really interested in it. And in 2013, it became a commercial product. But it's taken all those years for me to check, does it work? Does it work with every instrument? Does it work? Right, we need a bass clef story, but not just any old rhyme. We need it to be compatible, you know. So we go in the submarine, down, under.
Yes.
We go to alto clef bass. So everything fits. There is nothing in Stave House that does not make sense.
Creative logic.
Yeah, creative logic. So, you know, and I'm still, I'll wake up one day and think, you know, I could do this with Stave House. You know, and I've started realizing, you know, I can teach scales with it. We've come up with the key signature cafe song for grade theory now. We've done so much, and I'm always seeing what else it can do. It always has, you know, another life and another life. So it's stopped being early learning. It's grown.
It's fantastic. And that and that's a testimony to the fact that if the creative logic is accurately mapped to reality, then that logic, that metaphor continues to grow and continues to have real life. It doesn't become tenuous. It becomes, oh, that makes sense. And
yes, exactly.
Oh, this is another way of using it. Why does it work? It works because it's following a logic that is the inherent logic of music, for example, or physics, or whatever however you're applying the principles. I love that. And do you know why we came across you, Ruth?
No. Well, I'm not sure. I think I know now.
Yes. One of our employees at Bullet Map Academy has a child who's having great difficulty with music. And so we sat down and I looked at everything that she's doing. I'm her personal dyslexia tutor as well. And I said, right, everything that I know about dyslexia and organizing your ideas visually and getting things done with mind mapping, what are all the principles? How would all those principles have to be applied to music? And so I said to her, look, here's what has to happen. All the notes need to have characters.
Amazing, right?
All of them need to have a creative logic that makes sense to her so she can recreate it from her imagination. It's not arbitrary. It has to have a story behind it, and it has to have movement behind it, and ideally connected to the movement of walking. Because walking is the rhythm of music. That's where you feel rhythm while you walk naturally.
Yes.
So it has to have creative logic connected to the rhythm of walking. Then it's got to be visual. It's got to have some physical expression. But most of all of the logic must be transferable directly to reality. There must not be any, you know, oh, you've learned all of that. Let's find another way of applying that to written music. It's got to be immediately transferable to real written music. And I said, I know it's a high bar. And I know we could go away and recreate this for her if we needed to, but there's got to be something out there that does it. And when we looked and we analyzed different people's ways of coloring in notes and, you know, coloring in the bars and doing different things, let's put colors underneath the overlay and all of this kind of thing, we're like, yes, that's it a little bit. Yes, that's quite good a little bit. That's quite good. But there isn't an integrated whole. World that you can inhabit. And that's exactly what you've done here, Ruth.
Thank you. It's so important that you say that, because it's absolutely right. My big argument is you can do color strings or whatever you want to do, but Beethoven's Fifth is not written in blue, yellow, and green. You've eventually got to read the code, and you can keep pretending that you don't have to, but you have to eventually read the code. So why not do something that leads you to the code? Stop excusing the code. Most of the other accessible musical ways in, they focus on one thing. They're either good at rhythm, or they're good at playing, or, you know, they're good at moving, but they're not good at everything. And Stavehouse is actually it's a total package, and it does not water down where you want to go academically with your music.
Fantastic, Ruth. It's answered a lot of questions for me personally. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast episode. If you have, email me. Say thank you. Say hello. Don't worry about getting in touch. It's not like I get hundreds of emails from podcast listeners. I get emails from podcast listeners who say, oh, you must get lots of emails from lots of people. No, I don't actually. It's surprising. It's not like social media or whatever, where people put lots of comments in, etc. But so we do love, just email Darius at Bullet Map Academy. I'll put the link in the description below. We'd love to hear from you. And we've got all the descriptions for Stavehouse with Roof. We'll break it down for you. So for children, for teenagers, for teachers, etc. Ruth will give us all those links. We'll put it in the show note description. You can click on it and connect with her directly. So Ruth, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate
it. Thank you so much for having me. I've really, really valued the opportunity to talk about it. And it's been a fabulous, you know, fabulous opportunity actually to look at myself and perhaps to understand why Stavehouse is the way it is.
Yeah, I think if you wanted to market this to America as well, you're basically got a system that helps people with executive functioning difficulties to read music and learn to read music. So dyslexia has an executive functioning component. ADHD has an executive functioning component, and it's very clear that you have executive functioning difficulties. But you have executive functioning difficulties because the normal way of teaching executive function skills. Executive function skills are the skills you need to organize your life. Your normal way, the world's normal way of doing that is quite abstract, intellectual, writing in lists. But your executive function skill set is all based around visual, movement, dynamic. And what you've done is you've created an executive function skill set for yourself and imbued the way you teach the music with this executive function skill set that's much more visual and dynamic. And what you're doing is you're giving it to children in all sorts of different ways. And I think it's perfect for children with dyslexia. So I hope many more children with dyslexia come your way and use your resources.
The opportunity to talk about it, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. See you later.
Okay.
Bye. This podcast is sponsored by dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.